This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with Professor David Orr. We are in the building of which we were speaking as we went away, that is the Lewis Center for Environmental Studies. The collaborative nature of what you have done here, as we were going away, Bill was talking about not only is it designed for young people, but they get to participate over time, and this isn't stuck, it isn't done. Yes?
That's right. And, you know, most buildings will start with a depreciation schedule. You know that the value of the property will decline over time. And then a maintenance schedule, and those kind of are ways to offset each other. This project also has those, but it also has a technology trajectory. It's a building we hope learns. So that over time, 5 years or 10 years out, this is a better building with better technology than it is now.
The building learns?
The building begins to learn. And so can we build structures that get better with time? Not just age gracefully, but actually get better with time. And so as there are changes, let's say, in wiring or whatever, below the raised floor, all the air handling, all the wiring, all the guts of the building are there, and it's easy to get at. And so if you have to rewire something, you can reconfigure a wall. You can do that in a building like this. The photovoltaic array that's on the roof, there's a 59 kW array on the roof of this particular building, so it captures sunlight. That technology will improve.
The photovoltaic. As in, you all guys say that fast, but that's hard for some of us.
It's photo as in photograph, voltaic as in voltage. If you have a solar calculator with that little strip on it, that is a piece of photovoltaic material. Struck by sunlight, it generates an electric current. But the question here is, can you design buildings that improve with age? Now, this is a challenge. I mean, this is a start. It's not a perfect building. But it's a good building, and it's a building that, you know, think most of our spaces are kind of mindless spaces. They tell no story. You flip a switch, and where does the power come from? The materials in the place are from where? Well, we don't know, and so there's no story.
And to this point, we haven't cared.
That's right. We live in kind of mindless spaces. For your listeners, on the east side of this building, for example, there is a wetland and hardwood forest we planted, just a fragment, very small area. But this place was once, its biotic memory is this was a upland hardwood swamp. And so we tried to recreate that there on the east side of the building as a way to remind people of where they are. In the front of the building is a kind of poor man's version of Stonehenge. There is a gnomon or pole, and then there are gray concrete markers. And the shadow of that pole falls on those markers, so it marks the winter solstice or the equinox of the year or time. So it's a way to remind people of time and seasons. But buildings need to orient us. We build our buildings, we shape our buildings thereafter they shape us. And so what we tried to do in this was to think of the ways in which architecture can become an active agent in an ecologically viable or solvent kind of pedagogy. Can we teach young people where they are, how nature works, time and seasons, and then the ecological competence that goes with what happens here in the west side of the building and the north side of the building with orchards and gardens and food production and soil and biological diversity. We now have students coming more and more from metropolitan areas. These are kids whose minds are shaped by television, by computers, by freeways, by suburbs. They've been cut off from the natural world. And I think that entails oftentimes a grieving process, kind of a restlessness that, who am I? Where am I? Because we're now cut off from our evolutionary past. The signals that we got, and we're kind of hardwired in this way. E.O. Wilson from Harvard calls this biophilia, an innate affinity for life and lifelike processes. And now we find young people, I think, more and more cut off from that. So the role of architecture and landscape architecture, I think, is to begin to equip young people with the analytic skills and the practical abilities to begin to remake the human presence in the world in a way that is, that the words of our time are sustainable, and that's fine. We've heard some dialogue about sustainable, and that means kind of the bare bones of the ecological relationship between ourselves and our places. But it also needs to be done in a way that is spiritually sustaining. We got to create a world we want to be in, and that's a beautiful world, and that's a world for which we have an affinity, I think.
John Kagan, the great, very good historian of war, talks about war as being inevitable when there is just a fundamental, irreconcilable clash of values. Paula started out talking about you as a revolutionary, And most revolutions have to do with a major discomfort with values. And I have to believe that the kinds of things you're talking about, particularly in an academic setting, and I think part of your passion is a sense of values that is somehow or other distinct from the current value set, and that what you've tried to do here, and I think may have succeeded in doing, at least started on, is changing the value system.
John Keegan, at the end of the book you wrote, I think it was Masks of Command, talks about different kind of heroes and leadership. And in those few pages, I think he captures a good bit of the essence of what has to happen. And if you think of the agenda here, the human agenda, the kinds of things that have to occur, from ethnic cleansing and all the conflicts that we have currently, all the things that we have to do, and the list, the long list of things that young people now have to do in the course of this this 21st century, if the 22nd century is going to be a decent century on a planet in which they're going to want to live. I think there's a value shift here. And there's a question that came up this morning as we were talking about these things in the symposium. How much of this is old and how much of this is new? And there are clearly old values that need to be dusted off, resurrected, and old values that we know we have to have as a species, and values of compassion and good-heartedness and creativity and love and care and all of those kinds of things. Political values. I would be content at this point with the case made during our revolutionary era.
And, you mean the American Revolution?
The American Revolutionary era. And Thomas Jefferson, for example, who was Bill McDonough quoted this morning, in this famous exchange of letters with James Madison, talks about remote tyranny and how a generation has no right to place the next generation in debt. And you think about that lesson, and that's virtually the same lesson that Edmund Burke in Reflections on the Revolution in France was saying. So Jefferson, who is the founder of modern radical politics on one hand, and his opposite, virtually in the same time era, Edmund Burke, talks about our role in the current generation is that of trustee. And it is to pass on, as Burke put it, an entailed inheritance from the distant past to the distant future. Now, I changed one thing with Jefferson, just changed the idea that debt was just economic. And if debt could be ecological debt, loss of soils and biodiversity and ecological resilience, that's a change I think Jefferson would agree to, then that begins to place that in a very different context. And with Burke, just change the entailed inheritance from institutions, laws, customs of civil society to include the soils, biological diversity, clean air, clean water, ecological resilience, on which that entailed inheritance rests. And that's a change I think Burke would agree to. And you see a convergence in political values of left and right. We've gone past, we need to go past, this old idea that there's a left and there's a right. This is one planet. There's no left and right ecologically. There is one planet. And beginning to come to grips with how we manage that planet and how we do this in a way that's compassionate and fair in the largest possible sense. I would make one other addition to this, and it's an addition that Rachel Carson and Aldo Leopold, I think, would have agreed to and articulated, I think, as eloquently as it can be done. And that is, our sense of community has to be larger. It has now to embrace the biotic community. It's not enough to say in an anthropocentric way, and this is part of our religious heritage in some sense, and it's part of our cultural heritage, the baggage of Western civilization. But now we have to widen the sense of community to include other life forms and longer periods of time. And this is an ethical revolution. We can't, this building in many ways is part of applied ethics. How can you build buildings that don't cast this long shadow in future generations? One other thing I'd like to add to this. We've begun a study here called the 2020 Project. And the goal here is to look at all of our carbon emissions from how we power the campus. And carbon emissions, of course, are related to climate change. And by all evidence we have now, climate is changing very rapidly. We're the forcing agent. And it's our use of fossil fuels, burning coal and oil and natural gas. So we're beginning a study to look at carbon emissions with the idea that by the year 2020, this college would be climatically neutral. Now, part of this is to look at what that term means, climatically neutral, but this is raising a very interesting ethical question that Thomas Jefferson would have understood. If you begin to think about this, if Jefferson were here now, Jefferson would agree, I think, that no generation, no culture, no society, and no institution has the right to change the biogeochemical cycles of the Earth or impair the stability and integrity and beauty of biotic systems, the consequences of which will inevitably fall as a kind of irrevocable remote tyranny on future generations. That's slavery. And it's a slavery that differs from our standard thinking about slavery in one important dimension, or two important dimensions. One is it will be global. If we alter the climate radically, that is everyone for all time as we measure time. Secondly, there's no manumission. There's no prospect of being freed from that condition. That's permanent. Don't want to go there. So your question about values, I'd be content to dust off a lot of those old values, political values and religious values and so forth. I think they have served us well in the past, but they have to be adapted to very different conditions in the 21st century.
You raise something I had not thought about. I thought it in a different context, the connection you make with slavery. And part of the horror of the American variant was the no hope. I mean, not only you, but your children, you know, as far as forever at that time. Part of the challenge, the discussion this morning was an economic discussion, fundamentally. Now, that just happened to be the focus that was taken. But I found myself sitting there wondering where the civil rights movement would have been had the decision-making processes been subjected to the kinds of discussions that we had today. Is the technology there? What are the economic benefits? What are the short-term benefits? What are the long-term benefits? And you've raised this in a radically different way, and I think they connect.
And when we come back, we'll connect them. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Forgive the interruption. This is David Orr talking with Bill Russell, and I'm watching, intrigued. We'll all be back shortly. We hope you will be too.